A lot of people are questioning, will people come back to the theater? Of course they will. Of course they will. I have absolutely no doubt about that at all. And we have ruins of theaters. You know, they are thousands of years old. Like, it's part of who we are. It's part of our humanity.
Welcome to the Dance Rants podcast. I'm Dylan Holly, a freelance artist and teacher with an urban dance background based in the Netherlands.
And I'm Hayden Idris, a classically trained dancer now working for the Dutch modern dance company Introdance. This podcast is a platform to create discussion about dance and to learn and gain insight from our guests. We hope you enjoy. In this episode, we're talking to former NDT1 and Scapino dancer Rupert Tuki. During his dance career, Rupert acted as a dancer's representative and member of the Workers' Council, aiding with interdepartmental communication and organizational policy. Since his retirement from stage, Rupert has received his Master's in Arts Management and in 2019 became the Artistic Curator for NDT, helping tackle their COVID-related challenges. We were introduced to Rupert by one of his former colleagues and our recent guest, Sarah Reynolds. In this episode, he talks to us about retraining, COVID challenges and response, and more broadly about leadership and management in the arts and cultural sector.
So really great to have you here, Rupert. And
yeah, we really appreciated you sharing the episode with Sarah and everything.
No, not at all. She's we're sort of partners in crime. So I saw it and was like, oh, this is great. And anything to support. Just like one, initiatives from dancers, two, like a discussion around our industry and what's going on in it by people that are in it, I think is great. So yeah, it was a pleasure. It was a really nice surprise to see it and learn about it. Yeah, from Sarah. And now following you guys too. So not at all.
I'm blushing. but to quickly answer about the Masters, it's going well. It's nice to have something to do this year. Shitty that part of it has to be online, but we're lucky that not all of it has to be online. So that's cool.
Okay. But I can imagine it's been nice to have something to focus on with work being so up and down, not what, you know, it usually is. So I can imagine that's been a nice, like, healthy distraction.
Yeah. Especially since work is... Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so this has definitely been good for my, like, brain, heart and soul. Also to learn about, like, the therapeutic sides of dance is very beneficial, especially for like a lot of the topics we kind of end up coming across with people, just about the struggles you go through with dance or transitioning through dance or whatever. It's nice to read this stuff at the moment.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it's great when it has a direct, like, you can relate it directly to what you're doing on a daily basis. So it's not just this abstract thing that you're learning about, like, theoretically, and you're like, okay, I get it. But when you have, you know, you can actually see how it's implemented, or like implement it yourself, or see people going through those things and recognize that it just reinforces that whole learning experience in such a more profound way.
Did you have something similar when you did your master's? Yeah.
There was a lot of just actually like more just affirmation of things. Like, I really wanted to have this learning experience and have my mind blown on like a daily basis by things. And it wasn't, I'm going to be fair and say it wasn't that, but it was a lot of affirmation of what I did know and what I had experienced. And that in itself was really, it gave me a lot of confidence. Because I what I was seeing and putting together for myself was, I mean, correct is the wrong word, because sort of management studies, there is no sort of correct way, but it's everything was just sort of confirmed and solidified for me in my head about what it was. So it was interesting in the fact that it wasn't necessarily this huge steep learning curve that I was anticipating, but at the same time, yeah, the confidence that it gave me that and the trust in myself actually was huge. So, but it was a great experience, and I'm so happy that I did it, even just for that confidence that it gave me coming off of a career in dance where everything is so focused on that, and sort of stepping into the abyss of like what happens next. I suddenly felt like I had this tool bag that was, it was real, and it was not based on sort of feelings or what I had experienced. It was something more concrete, or at least that's how it felt to me anyway.
And obviously then after dancing, you're now doing, are you still doing the curation role at NDT?
No, I don't work at NDT anymore.
Okay. But that's the role that you took like post your career on stage, right?
Eventually, yeah. I stopped with NDT in 2017, and I kind of, that first season, I was like, you know what? I just want to leave it open. I don't really want to do, I want to have space, you know, after what it is being, you know, a dancer, especially in Holland with, you know, the amount of shows that under normal situations we, you know, the companies have, you know, like you feel like you're sort of half your life is spent on that bus. And then there's, yeah, all of what that is, like working in that Dutch context as a dancer, I really just wanted some freedom and headspace to see what would come. And my year got filled really quick, which in a way was great. But I had like 4 months of freedom, and then freedom's the wrong word. I had 4 months of being able to decide for myself what I wanted to do with my time. And that was really nice just to slow down, travel a bit just for myself, do things that there's just not time for when you're dancing full time. And then there were some things that came up at NDT in like different departments. So I worked for a little bit in the marketing and fundraising department, which officially is the commercial affairs department, they call it at NDT. They knew that I was interested in that, and somebody was taking, they were going to spend a few months in the States and sort of work remotely, but sort of half the time. So they were like, oh, it would be great if we had like an extra pair of hands around here. Would you be interested? So of course I said yes and jumped to that. And then there was, they needed a rehearsal director for NDT2 for like 6 months after that. So they were like, hey, would you like to do this? And so these things kind of just happened. And then midway through that point of being with NDT2, I got accepted onto the full-time master's course at Middlesex University in London. So I was like, okay, I'm leaving, I'm off. I'm going to go on this adventure now. And on the day that I arrived in the UK, actually moving there, I got a message from Paul Lightfoot like, hey, let's chat. I've got something I need to talk to you about. And I kind of knew what it was because I, you know, close to the organization and been working in it and heard rumors and was like, okay, I think I know what this is, but okay, the timing really sucks. You know, like sold my house in Holland. My partner and I, we shut down Holland. We left, like all of our stuff was now in London. So as we were unpacking boxes, we were like, I think we're going to be going back.
Yeah.
Sort of long story short, I said like, okay, this is amazing. I'm so interested, but give me, if you can, like, I would love to have just a few months to not think about it, but just to have this experience, but know that I am like, you know, I'm probably going to say yes. I just can't commit to saying yes right now. He was like, that's absolutely fine. Take the time you need. If you could let me know by the new year, that would be wonderful. And yeah, so that's what happened. So I was in London for a year and then went back in, I guess, what was it, May 2019, and then had a small transition period with the with Anders Hellström, who was in that role of artistic producer and curator before. So we had some time together, which was great to sort of share information and me just to sort of sit back a little bit and see how that all worked. And then, spent the whole of last season doing that role, which was great, but a season cut short because of COVID, like for everyone. So, it was a shame not to get to see the season out with all of the plans that we had in place. But, you know, it's okay. It's fine. There are worse things going on in the world for people. So, it was what it was, and now I'm here in Vancouver on another adventure. So,
yeah, you're fleshing your already impressive CV out in an even more impressive way.
Oh man, it doesn't feel impressive. I'm figuring it out as I go along, you know.
Well, I can tell you, I've never read a more impressive CV in my life. / intimidating.
No. You know what, just, you know, when you find something that takes your interest, just follow it. And that's why, you know, I think that like this podcast that you're doing is so great. Like, you guys are talking with really interesting people, having like interesting conversations, like it's out there. Like, this is, it's all great stuff. And, you know, I think we all at an early age as dancers had that in us. There was this little, you know, as little kids, we were, or, you know, whenever we came to it, but there was this like, oh, this is great. I love it. And we just, without questioning, followed. And I guess that gets tougher as you get older. Like, we question more, we doubt more, we have more responsibilities, the odds are greater, right? So then we, yeah, it all feels a bit more daunting. But I think if we can stay true to that essence of following what it is that gives you a kick and makes you want to get up in the morning and do it, I feel like we all will end up on the right path.
Yeah, I think it's that thing where you're always told at a young age, like, follow the thing that you're interested in, not because of the money, but because you're interested in it. And, like, you know, it's easy to do that with dance at first, but then you start studying it and everything, and you have to hit a certain point where you're not doing things without thinking of the money. And once that kind of starts happening, it's harder for me to say yes to dance things if someone can't pay, because, you know, I've learned you have to have a value, and it can be unhealthy to do it. But in this setting, you know, this is really just a creative outlet for myself and Hayden in a year where we had very little things to do.
And, yeah,
you know, there is no income inside of this, but it's a lot of fun. And we both are seeing, even if it's just the kind of emotional reward we get from like meeting and chatting to other people, it's so valuable. And it is really, really reinforcing that, you know, do follow the things you're interested in, not because of the money, because you're interested in them.
For us also, the podcast it's really a resource to like have these kind of conversations that we otherwise wouldn't have, and learn about topics that we otherwise wouldn't necessarily talk about. And also then we were having those conversations between us, and to include other people in those conversations makes it even more valuable. And then to be able to share that with people is special too. So, but talking about things that that you find interesting, what was then your interest to pursue the management course in London?
I think I really just wanted to educate myself. You know, I think for me, I stopped, and I guess it's kind of similar for most dancers, like my sort of academic and more formal education stopped at a young age, which at the time was wonderful because it meant I got to dance more. So great. And the sort of UK system, I left high school at 16 and went to train full time and got like a diploma in dance and theatre performance, which was wonderful. But that diploma in the real world, or like the world outside of dance, didn't really give me anything, didn't really give me something to stand on. And I felt that that was really important for myself. And I wanted to, I wanted to have a solid foundation once my dance career was over that I could stand on. And I didn't want to be reliant on the contacts that I had to give me opportunities to be able to build my CV, even though that's kind of what happened. And I'm super lucky to have had those opportunities. But I also wanted to do that for myself. And I wanted to leave Holland because I wanted to get a different perspective. I'm from the UK originally, so there was also a draw just to sort of go back. And I wanted to be in a cultural capital. I looked at courses in Paris, in New York, and London. And I also made the ultimate decision sort of based on the fact that I didn't have a bachelor already. So I had to find somewhere that was willing to look at my experience as a dancer and the things that I had done. I had to find a way in. I had to find a loophole, and I had to find a university that was willing to look at my professional experience up until that point and say, oh, okay, you have enough experience and understanding of this industry to be able to study at this level. And that was tricky. And, you know, with the wonderful support of the Omscholingsfonds and that financial support that you have from them, it was really, you know, the world was my oyster had I had a bachelor. I really could have been able to apply to so many different universities, but that wasn't necessarily the case for me. So I had to find my own way, and I did find a great course, and I found people that a university that was willing to look at my experience and whose aim of all of their courses that they have is more from an experience point of view and not necessarily just from a pure theoretical point of view. And that was also attractive for me because as a dancer, we learn by doing. We don't learn by talking about what the steps are or what the piece is. We connect to it on a physical and an emotional level through a process of learning or creating with a choreographer. And that, I think, for me, that it was important to understand my learning style and find somewhere that also suited that. And I did, and it was a really fulfilling year, and I got lots of opportunities to connect with people in arts and cultural management across different genres of arts and culture in London, and that was really, really valuable and a really inspiring time. And to be in London as well and live for best part of a year and be able to just have access to all of those amazing things that right now none of us have access to, museums and theaters and music and dance. And it was just really wonderful to be somewhere where there is so much and just to be able to take it all in.
It's funny to hear you talk about universities, especially at the level that you studied, which was the master's in arts management, that the universities weren't willing to look at your experience. I feel like that should be even more valuable to be able to exit a course like that and bring along with you all the experience that you have as an operator in the sector. It's kind of the best of both worlds.
I guess, you know, there is guidelines, you know, it's education and it's, they have to have parameters around who they're letting in and, you know, because ultimately that keeps the course elevated. But I think it would be nice if there was a little bit more leeway in actually looking at the individual and not just, okay, do you have the academic credentials to be able to take this course?
Yeah. But that is kind of the way things work these days. It's why it is such a benefit to be able to do a master's or something, is that so much of society will give you more opportunities if you have these things just on your name or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's just another, it's a foot in the door, or it's, a foot closer to the door when, you know, there's a stack of CVs and it doesn't necessarily mean you're the best person for it. Maybe
not at all.
Better, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. It's like CVs. It's like when you go for an audition, if you have worked with somebody that is a recognizable name, then your CV will get read more thoroughly than someone else's. And
yeah,
it's a pity that things work like that. But yeah, in a time when there's so many people applying for everything, every little bit of an advantage you can get is worth doing. And especially if it's a rewarding course that you enjoy, like learning about, and it gives you something on a information level or a confidence experience level, it's win-win-win.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if it was affirming, then did you feel like while you were studying that you kind of already had all of your ideas about management now were kind of already there when you were a dancer? Or would you feel like certain things have really shifted?
I feel like shifted is too big of a word. I feel like I understand the sort of more theoretical concepts behind the idea of what management is or what management can be. Let's just say I have more of an understanding of what it is. So now I'm able to recognize and make decisions for myself that come from both a sort of intuitive but also theoretical place.
And did it also, I suppose, like equip you with the skills to be able to pursue the ideas of management that you had maybe previously before the course?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. And, you know, we had this an events management module, which I was like, oh, this kind of sounds interesting. And actually, it turned out to be really useful during opening back up after COVID. You know, how do we use the space? How do we engage with the building? How do we get people in safely. And one of those things about sort of managing events is flow of people, is using the space, is health and safety, is all of these things that we kind of just take for granted. But when you sort of start looking at them from a more theoretical perspective, it was really, it really helped me then when we were, you know, okay, we can go back into the building, but we can't use it in the same way. How do we use it? Mm. And it was really there was a real direct link that I was like, ah, okay, I know how to do this.
I've learned this. It's okay.
Yeah, I've learned this. It's kind of nuts and boltsy, and it is kind of what it is. And we need to, you know, get the blueprints of the building out and figure out how to move everybody around. And but I think, yeah, in terms of sort of the management of people, you know, for me, it's always been very much about how you communicate. Mm-hmm. And what you communicate, and that can be really hard. And I think, you know, making that shift in a relatively small amount of time from being a dancer in the studio to being in what that position was in terms of seniority within NDT, I could really sort of start to see how communication is so important, even more so than I thought. So that sort of practical experience so close after finishing my master's was really valuable, actually, in sort of solidifying some ideas that I'd already had and concept that I'd sort of learned about management during the master's, because I was dealing with it firsthand, like right away. And that was great. That was a really valuable experience. But for me, it always comes down to, you know, communication and how you communicate and what you communicate. And I think it's really, we're entering with a younger generation of dancers coming into companies, you know, their whole idea of how we communicate is completely different. Mm-hmm. You know, like I remember being 15 and I got my first like mobile phone. And then like discovering that you could send a text and just that something could be so instant with somebody and you could chat. So we now have, you know, people in companies that haven't known anything else but that. So their expectation of how things are communicated is really, really different. And I think that probably across all organizations, but because of the sort of youthful nature of dance, they're kind of experiencing it maybe sooner than maybe other sectors would. And I mean, sectors are, you know, not just in arts and culture, but, you know, dance is a young profession. And yeah, there's a whole generation of younger dancers now and artists coming in saying, no, you can't communicate with us like that anymore. And so it's really interesting to figure out those new ways and how to do that and how we need to look at what we're communicating, when we're communicating it, the channels that we're communicating it through. It's an evolving moment in how we do that.
Would you feel that the younger generations want to communicate more or less, or is it just that it's a different kind of expectation?
I think there's more and there's a different expectation.
Okay. It's good that it's more wanting more communication, because I think that's really important. But it is,
yeah.
If they aren't good at, say, like, communicating in person, I can also assume that that creates other dynamic issues when it comes to big company meetings or whatever, that I think younger generations feel more comfortable communicating via text and stuff than they do potentially.
Yeah.
This is an assumption now.
Me neither. And I don't know. That's not something I've experienced or come across yet, but I definitely feel that there is, it's two things. It's communication and it's information. And I think definitely the methods of how generations now are growing up and how integrated communication is, and then the information that they have access to, is just so much more. You know, like we can all see each other and we're, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning with me and it's 7 o'clock in the evening with you, and we can record this. And, you know, 15 years ago, this wouldn't have been possible. So this idea of how we share information and how we communicate is really, really, it's really changed. It's changed a lot. And I think for people that are in management positions now, there's a challenge on how to do that, and how to give information that is relevant and necessary because my experience has been that, yes, we as dancers, we want to know everything. And there's sometimes this idea that information is being withheld. Mm. And I get it. Like I would sometimes feel that myself. But at the same time, there's just so many things going on and things change so much that it's better to share that information when it's ready to be shared. And that's not out of at all from my side thinking that, oh, you know, people can't handle that information or they shouldn't have that information. It's just there are conversations happening at other levels within an organization that don't necessarily need everybody to be involved following that thread. You know what I mean? And once something is clearer, then that can be communicated. But the back and forth and how things change, and it's a lot. It's really it's not necessarily complex information, but it's complex in getting to, okay, this is what it's going to be.
Do you think the method of communication and I guess sharing that information, especially with like a large group of people like dancers are in an organization, do you think that is something that can be like systemized and that would help the situation? Because I read your thesis and in that you talk about the idea of rumors and that some people are having in organizations information before others and that can lead to frustration within a group of people. And do you think that that's exacerbated maybe because there's not this systematic way of sharing information or communicating with people?
Maybe. But I think that there's also, you know, this, you know, rumors, you know, I've seen them happen myself. You know, you walk for a costume fitting and you see a bunch of costumes hanging on a rack and you're like, why are those out? You know, and then, you know, and then the next question, well, where's the casting for those? But there are many different departments within a dance organization that are all working on their own thing. And I think that there has to be trust, and that's difficult to build. And when trust has been broken, it's even more difficult to regain that. But I think, you know, we all have a responsibility to use the proper channels of communication that are there. So, you know, whatever that is, if that's through the reps or if that's through the ballet masters or if that's, you know, however that works, you know, every organization has their own way. But I think there has to be a sort of give and take. And I hate using that word because it gets used so much. But I think there has to be a common understanding that everybody is working for the same goal. And maybe those costumes are hanging there because they're come back from the dry cleaners and they're going to get a final check before going into storage. You know, you just don't know. And so that information, given that example, doesn't need to be given to everybody because that department is just doing what it is they need to do. I don't know. Should it be systemized? Should it be something that becomes so unorganic? I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe it needs to be. Maybe it needs to be trialed out and maybe it would be something that works. But I would hate, you know, we work in, as dancers and dance companies, there is something so human about them that I would hate to see that human connection go from just that human interaction to be able to knock on a door and be like, hey, I've seen this or heard that. Can you give some clarification?
Yeah, that's a question I had for you actually, because I think like one of the overwhelming things that the ideas that I had from reading your thesis was this idea of communication and how pivotal that is to making an organization run well. Do you think that that's reliant on the leader and the leadership style that person has? Because that's something, yeah, that's the other big thing that you talk about in the thesis. I mean, the thesis is called Leadership in Dance, right?
Yeah. I think that it definitely comes from a leader, but it also comes from it's not just communication to the dancers, it's how communication goes from a leader to all departments. And you know, it's it's tricky because they set a tone they set a tone for the work, the work ethic, the how we communicate with each other, what gets communicated, the you know, identity, the culture. They, you know, especially an artistic leader, they, that's their responsibility to create that in their vision of what they want the company to be artistically. And I think that there should be more emphasis put on and understanding how that can have an impact. And it also kind of ties in to sort of the idea of power structures and hierarchy, which has been a big topic in 2020, and sort of looking at those power structures that are in place and are they being abused. And it's a really complex situation. And, you know, you can look at it through the Me Too lens or the Black Lives Matter lens, or, you know, but ultimately, I believe that a leader sets a tone for the organization. And I expect by the time you're in that position, that should be something that is understood, is my expectation. And maybe that's too high of an expectation, but that's what I hold myself to. And so then it's, I kind of expect that from other people. And sometimes that's not fair because we're all different. But that's, yeah, that's my, that's, it was also something that Sarah and I were really worked hard for as reps, was to, yeah, get that communication like flowing in it for the, for us as dancer reps, for the dancers, what felt like a healthier way. Mm. And it's not blaming or saying that it was bad, but there are always things that can be improved.
Yeah, and I think it's healthy that you should be able to have these conversations with a leader, like, and you should be able to challenge them on things that you're like, hey, I think you could actually, there could be something better here in like structured for us or for everybody, or at least let's put it on the table and discuss, because there's either a breakdown in communication or there's expectations not being met, or
I think expectations have a lot to do with it too.
Yeah, but but expectations are natural. Like, I think it's become a dirty word, expectations, mm-hmm. these days, that when you talk about expectations, everyone's a bit like, oh, you should change your expectations. But it's just like unsung expectations are what's dangerous. When you have one in your head, like that you don't mention, right. And then you expect. But if you should be able to say to your like leader, like, I expect, like, I hope to be able to expect you to lead by example and whatever, like, for example, yeah. I'm not saying that someone isn't, but I think I would agree with what you're saying. In my opinion, a leader should be able to be held up to good high expectations, since they are in that position, which kind of they become the face or the head of the organization.
And also because it is such a complex issue, and like you said, like, should you systemize it or not, that's a huge question. And especially within the arts, and because it's so complex, I guess that makes that the person in that role even more important.
And it's tricky, though. Then as dancers, you know, we kind of put in this time pressure cooker that other performing artists don't have, and you know, the clock is ticking. There's an injury away from it being the end. There's the expectations that you put on yourself to reach a company or to get cast in a role or to work with a certain choreographer that we all have, and those are all valid. But then within a company situation, you've got every single person in the room with that. And so that's what I kind of meant by sort of the expectations of what it actually is. And so maybe sort of formalizing something to a point where there is a common understanding from a group of dancers, and not, you know, from 20 individuals, but as a collective, that there can be something like, okay, this is kind of what we've agreed upon that we would like, or this is what we would like to try, or, you know, what do you think about this? But I think there's really there should be an emphasis for dancers everywhere not to be passive. And I don't mean that in terms of not standing up for things, but not to expect everybody else to have the answers. Like, empower yourself. Yeah, totally. Like, come up with the solution yourself. like propose that, like meet people at the table with ideas for how to make things better and not just this doesn't work, fix it.
Yeah, like join the conversation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was really nice to join the Dancers Council meeting a few weeks ago.
Great.
And it's so great that like this is happening as people are starting to join. But it's like, you know, how many dancers are in the Netherlands? Like so many. And, you know, we all fit in one Zoom screen, like for the amount of people that joined that conversation. Now, this is it's a different situation because this is like kind of the preparatory conversation to like find the information that we need to talk about or that Sarah and the others are putting forward to the CAO and whatnot. But in general, I think not enough dancers are joining the conversation. And I think it's quite impressive looking at how long you've been joining the conversation in companies. Like, I don't think you meet many dancers who you were a rep in Scapino. And as soon as you went into NDT, you became a rep in NDT and you were there. You were a rep the entire time you were there.
Well, when I left Scapino, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to get involved. Just going to go to NDT. I want to just dance. Like, I'm so happy that this opportunity happened and I'm so excited about it. I just want to dance. And I remember being like at the top of the stairs, like just before Christmas, and Sarah was like, you're going to join the OR. And I was like, I don't want to. No. She was like, but you speak Dutch. You know, you're perfect. And she got me in there, which it would have happened at some point because it's just in my nature and I've come to accept that now. But I'm guilty as charged.
I was
involved always.
Yeah, by the sounds of things, like you played a big part in the Dancers Council, like that initiative kind of came from the two of you going to talk to other people in the biz companies, right? Like it wasn't their goal at the time, but at least Sarah explained it, kind of came from there.
Yeah, there was this, I'm going to get the name wrong and I don't, there's this, the Omscholing has or was doing like an annual sort of get together. And it was at Corso that year for people that were studying to come and share their stories about their path from freelance dancer. Well, from it was an invite to everybody, but it was happening in the day, and I was not cast, or I didn't have rehearsal that day, and I was like, you know what, I'm gonna go. And I looked around the room and there was a lot of representation from the freelance scene, but it was on like a Wednesday at 3 o'clock, and I just thought to myself, this is wonderful that this is happening, but there's a whole sector. And I never worked freelance, and it was a choice because I know that like it wasn't what I wanted to do. But I was like, there is a whole sector and like of the dance community in the Netherlands that are not here because they just can't be.
Yeah, it's and that sort of time.
Yeah, I was like, me. So I just kind of thought there should be something where we can all come together, and because there were some breakout groups. And they were talking about what was going on in the industry and what was happening at that point in time. And I was just like, well, we all have things too. Like maybe, yes, there's sort of some more, you know, we have like fixed contracts and, you know, like these things that just are part of what that is, dancing with one of the biz organizations. But there are still issues that we're experiencing. And having come from Scapino to NDT, I was like, well, there are similar things here. I'm seeing common threads, and maybe there should be something where we, all of the biz organizations get together, or at least the representatives. And that week or like the week after, I was having a meeting with Paul about my plans for studying. And I ran it by him and I was just like, what do you think? And he was like, this sounds great. Let's do it. Like we can offer space. We can provide food for you guys. Like, let's give it a go. And I think then I ran it by Sarah and she was like, let's do it. And we just reached out and started emailing the reps from Scapino, Intro Dance and the National Ballet. And everyone was like, yeah, let's do it. So I think sort of 6 months later, we had the first meeting, and that was just after I stopped dancing. So I was kind of there at the very beginning. And then I was like, you know, I'm willing to be involved in these conversations in these first few meetings, but then I don't know where I'm going. I'm stopping, and I, you know, you guys should, you know, carry this on. And it's really wonderful to see how it's growing now, and more people are being involved. And Sarah's really spearheading it, and she's really, yeah, championing some great things and being a place where the dancers in the Netherlands can have their voices heard, even if nothing comes of it. But there's a space where you can throw ideas around, where you can hear what other people are experiencing. You can see what it is that they're implementing and what's working or what's not working, and come up with maybe solutions that help everybody in some small way. And that's, I think it's fantastic. And I'm really happy to see it going, growing and growing and getting more and more traction, and people from outside the Netherlands being like, hey, what is this? I want to hear about it and what's going on. I think it's really cool to, you know, you make a drop and you see that it ripples, and that's it's really good. And I wish them all a lot of success with the continuation, and you guys too, however you stay connected with that. And I was meant to go to a meeting, but because of COVID, that meeting didn't happen. So I was like, you should come and check, just, you know, see what we're talking about and meet the people that are there now, because, you know, there's changeover and new faces. And yeah, but I guess it's the situation now, and how all the companies have had to pivot with, you know, the consequences of COVID are probably raising a whole bunch of topics for discussion there that might not have been discussed before.
Yeah, that's something you mentioned, that you were in the role of the curator at NDT when the pandemic started. How did you deal with that in the initial stages? And how have you seen the leadership handle that since, across the dance industry, I guess, more?
So we were on tour when it happened, and we were in Montreal, and you know, we were hearing and seeing what was going on through social media in the Netherlands, and you know, everyone was kind of connecting to their countries and being like, oh wow, like, okay, this is suddenly like escalating very quickly. And things in Montreal, it was like everything was calm. There were a few people just like, oh, okay. And sitting in the audience every night watching the show, hearing people cough was a little bit uncomfortable. It was like, oh. I'm like, okay, part of my job is watching the show, but I don't want to sit in this room with 1,200 people. Is this the best thing to be doing? But it quickly, in Montreal, they were like, okay, we're going to shut down the theater, I think after the second show. And we were all in there rehearsing, and they were like, you have to get out by tonight. So the crew had to like do a really quick breakdown of everything and get it loaded. And yeah, there was still a question mark on whether the tour would continue, because we were meant to go to Toronto and Ottawa. And at that point they hadn't closed. So we were kind of like, do we stay? Do we go? We had a company meeting in the hotel, and it was clear from the majority of everyone that we would rather just go home. So communication back to Holland. Okay, get us all on a flight home. And they did. Within sort of 24 hours, we were on a plane back to Amsterdam, and we all sort of went our separate ways, not knowing what was going on. Yeah, like, okay, bye, see ya. We just have to go home. I'll go to the store and get some hand sanitizer and hopefully some toilet roll.
Yeah,
it was interesting, because, you know, obviously there was a change of artistic directorship at NDT. So we kind of really started to enter into that transitional phase. And when it came to sort of programming and looking at what was going to happen, it was clear that the rest of the season was going to not be what we expected, but it wasn't clear for how long that would continue and to what extent that would affect the new season, so 2021. And at an early stage, we were all in a Zoom call together with Emily Molnar, who's the new artistic director, and it was clear that things were going to affect the new season. And at that point, yeah, myself and Paul both said, no, it's good if you take the lead on everything for next season. We'll finish out this season. And yeah, you take the whole season. I mean, there was a lot already programmed in terms of like stuff, you know, the season was kind of done. But of course, that needed to shift. And so a lot of things for the company, how that was going to shift, what they were going to do, that was then Emily took that over before she arrived and was kind of, yeah, she was, I think from sort of April, she was already busy with that. And then we were busy with the films that we made at the end of the season, the one from Paul and the one from Saul. So that was keeping us busy with what was going on at that moment. And yeah, keeping everybody safe, keeping everybody up to date with what was going on. You know, we managed to be back in the building, I think May 11th. We started classes again, but structuring how we were going to do that and make that work. So it became very much, you know, instead of the season kind of rolling as it does, you know, we all have, you know, the day, the shows are there. It's all sort of blocked in, you know, when which choreographer is coming, the premiere's on this date, that kind of all just fizzled away. So it was not so much about bigger picture questions. It was more immediate. So, okay, how do we get everyone back into the space? How do we keep everybody engaged up until we can do that? How do we offer things to help keep people in shape? How do we get them some flooring? You know, the technical director was like, yeah, there's pieces of floor I've cut. You know, I put them in the back of my car and went round and sort of put them on the street and was like, okay, I'm going to be on the street between this time and this time. If you want floor, come and pick it up. So it kind of became... it really became about dealing with everything in the moment and finding a way through it. And yeah, just keeping everybody on the same page, which it was hard for all of us, I think, in whatever capacity, just to know where we were. It was kind of this, you know, where are our feet? Where's the ground? Where's something solid that we know?
Where's the floor?
Yeah, where's the floor? It was in rolls in the back of my car. so it became, for me, it became less about looking at the sort of this season of NDT and what that would mean, and more about, okay, how do we get everybody back in the building? Can we get everybody back in the building? Can we hold on to the tours? You know, should we hold on to the tours? How long do we wait? All of these kinds of discussions with all of the different players involved in that. In, you know, yeah, when do we say, okay, we're not coming? Mm-mm. Do we wait for them to say we're canceling? All of these, you know, how is that for the relationship? What does that mean in terms of fees? What, you know, all of these questions that up until this point we're just sort of not really thought so much about, just because, you know, it's all kind of done. But, you know, we're in a global pandemic all of a sudden, and we're all figuring out together how best to move forwards.
It's almost kind of nice though that there was this delegation of tasks, so that you could look after the immediacy of things and I guess the welfare of the people underneath you without having to worry about the future.
Yeah, it was nice because it was also like the future, and it still kind of is now. It's kind of an abstract term.
Yeah.
For our industry, you know, like what, you know, when are the theaters going to open? You know, and every country has a different, is doing something different. So, you know, what does that mean in your specific geographic location? And let's see. But, it was nice to just sort of be really in the moment with everybody, knowing that I was going to leave too. And, you know, it was like, okay, well, you don't like teaching? Well, you're going to have to do it because we can't bring people in from the outside anymore. But yeah, everyone just mucked in and got on with it. And that created a really nice vibe. And that carried through right until the end with the filming, which was really up until the last day of the season. I think, yeah. Paul finished at like 9:30 on the last day of the season, but, you know, with as many people as legally allowed in the space yeah, of course, saying goodbye to some dancers that left in a non-traditional way and how to celebrate that and how to honor the careers that they had, because there was a few from NDT1 especially that were retiring. But I feel like we did it in a nice way, and there was a great sense of spirit and sort of love of what we all do, which at that juncture was really, it was really special to be able to make that happen at the end of a season that was just felt so suddenly pulled from beneath us. Mm-hmm. To be able to come together in that capacity was a really, it was a really beautiful time.
Do you have a question on this topic, Aiden?
No, just like in one of the things that you said, which was Paul making those ballets that you guys filmed. I heard that those were created in a really short amount of time, right?
Crazy short amount of time. Yeah. I think Paul's piece was like over half an hour, and I think he did it in like 19 days.
Yeah. How was that to also to organize all the filming and things like that? How was that to do in such a short amount of time?
I mean, we started like before, and here's this example of communication. Like, we were busy with it a long time before sort of putting those pieces in place. Like, okay, who could film it? Do we need to bring anyone in? Like, how do we, like, what do we have that we can use? What do we need to rent? Sets, costumes, like all of these discussions were happening before to figure out if it was going to be possible before we could say to the group of dancers, okay, this is what we're going to do, because we had to get all our ducks in a row. And if it had been like everything at the same time, it never would have happened. So it was quite sort of methodical, but there's also a great team of in the audiovisual department. And after so long with the company, they were, you know, everybody, you know, the dancers know the style, the crew know all of their set pieces that they want to use. They know, yeah, just they knew what was possible, and it was in Lucent on the stage. So it was kind of a nice moment to be in that space, because it's, you know, not, no one's, yeah, it's going to disappear, I guess, soon as the company moves into a new building. But it was, yeah, because of that knowledge of an understanding of each other, it was able to go quite quickly and quite smoothly. And it was nice, some sort of older people who had left the company that were part of either the costume or audiovisual department, or, you know, the lighting designers, they kind of all came back for this project at the end, which was, it, you know, made it really special. But it was quick, but you know, it was also about planning because of COVID. Actually, I think it, in some odd ways, it might have made it easier, because we had to be really clear with, okay, what scenes are we filming? Because we can only have, you know, X amount of people in the building and in the space at this time. So this gave that parameter, that gave also gave a guide to how it could be broken down and how things could be filmed. And then with that in-house team from the audiovisual department, just discussions on how to make it work. And like everyone, like dying to get back to work. So as soon as we were rehearsing, they were in the studio with us watching things being made. So they were able to be part of that dialogue from a much earlier time than in a normal season, where there are all of these performances and touring and premiere and all of this stuff. So everyone's kind of working at capacity. It was kind of like everyone's been off and we can all start fresh at the same time with working with just sort of one idea. And so that was, I think that helped. So in some ways, I think COVID was almost a blessing for that project. It enabled it to go ahead in a way that without it might have made it even more complex, actually.
Funny.
Yeah. And I'm just realizing that speaking about it.
Yeah, it's, well, some things fall, just kind of do fall into place. It's kind of like what we said earlier, like this podcast probably wouldn't have started, we wouldn't have had as much time to do this otherwise.
Exactly. Yeah.
What's the saying again? When God closes a door, he opens a window. I wanted to ask on the fundraiser, what was the title again? The fundraising committee or something, where you had to talk with private entities for...
I mean, this was kind of just part of things that... Okay, I was going to make this short, but I feel like it's going to be longer.
Well, Well, maybe I can like give a question and maybe that helps channel it. We spoke a little bit to Sarah about this, about like the trajectory of like funding in the Netherlands. And then also we've spoken to some people who are from the States, and you know, in the States it's already extremely private funded. So I guess just a little bit of information on your experiences with that, like the benefits that come from it, the negatives.
That's
not a very specific question, is it?
No, I mean, I think, you know, the European model of having companies that are subsidized much more than in other parts of the world, and sort of specifically like North America, I think in times of crisis, like that we're seeing right now with COVID, it allows for an organization to keep going, even if it's just in like first gear, but it can still keep chugging along. And I think this is hugely vital, because we are going to come back. This is going to end. And I don't think all of the expertise, all of the knowledge, all of the beautiful works that get created and everything that takes, I see it now being where I am. I see it being hit so hard by something like this, much harder than in Europe, where there is just more financial support. And so just sort of putting that in the context of where we are globally right now, I see it as a huge, huge benefit. There is the ability to hunker down and ride out the storm and sort of know that you'll kind of pop back up, especially for organizations like the biz organizations in the Netherlands, maybe for some that are funded on a more, in a different way, on a sort of project basis, it's very different. And I don't know enough about them to be able to talk to that. But when you have in a context where there's so little support in comparison to European companies, when that funding is less, you really see that something like what we're all experiencing now can be the end. It can be over for a company. It can be over for dancers. The career can be done, and that's that. And I think that's just a terrible shame. A lot of people are questioning, will people come back to the theater? Of course they will. Of course they will. I have absolutely no doubt about that at all. You know, we have ruins of theaters. You know, they are, you know, thousands of years old. Like, it's part of who we are, it's part of our humanity, and it's only going to be a matter of time. So I think it's really tough, and I see it happening around me here, that there is just this struggle to stay alive. And so before you can even really start looking at what the future might be, it's the question is, do we have a future? And I think I think it saddens me, and that's not a judgment on whether it's better or worse. It's just for me, from my experience that I've had up until this point, I find it sad that something like this can be the end of something that people have dedicated their whole lives to.
I think it's definitely better to have state funding, but I guess the reason I'm asking about it is that it doesn't necessarily feel like it's going to stay around that much longer in Europe, because like Netherlands has just gotten the guillotine. It's like lost like 40-50% of its funding, and now new governments could bring that back or could shoot us even harder. So I guess I'm just a little bit curious. Obviously, in a more normal setting, like is searching for private funding, how much of a difficulty is it? Or is it an art? Is it a skill? Or are companies quite open to it in a normal setting when you know they're not hemorrhaging cash because of COVID as well?
I think it's definitely an art and a skill to be able to do it and do it well. So it's about finding those people that can do that. And it's a huge amount of work, and it's about stewardship. It's about, you know, finding somebody who has an interest and a spark and keeping up with them for 5 years, maybe, until they finally decide to say, okay, I want to donate to your organization. It's not a quick fix, and it takes time and dedication, and it takes stewardship to enable this to happen in a successful way. And if funding gets cut so quickly and so drastically, it's going to take time for organizations to bounce back, because it's not something that is just, it's not like, oh, well, next season we'll just fundraise more. How do you do that? Does the organization have the capacity to do that? Does it have the infrastructure to do that? Does it have the knowledge to do that? Do you need to outsource it? Do you need to create more positions? Well, probably, and all of that's going to take more cash, mm-hmm. which ultimately, until you start seeing something back from it, you're going to be taking it away from the artistic product, which is what you want to support. So it's a really tricky one. And I think there's a healthy balance to be found between a certain level of state funding and finding funds from either corporate sponsors or individual donors. But doing that is it's an art form. And you need a whole team of people. And also you have to see, it's also, I think, you know, especially in America, people, it's sort of ingrained in the culture that if you have money, you give back, because that's your responsibility as a privileged person with money, is that you give back to nonprofit organizations. And it's very much ingrained in people in the US, and in Europe, we don't necessarily have that. So it's also, you have to give time for a cultural shift to happen, and it's not immediate, and it doesn't happen overnight. And it's also, you know, there's a lot of like how these people are recognized. And within a Dutch context, there are a lot of people with money that they don't necessarily want to be recognized. They don't want to have their name out there. They don't want the studio to be named after them or to have a dancer named after them. My time when I did do that little sort of month with at San Francisco Ballet, was it really became apparent for me at that point that it is not a one size fits all, and you cannot implement what is happening in the States into a European perspective, because it's completely different.
It's interesting you mentioned this like cultural shift as well, because I'm sitting here thinking, when we're talking about privatizing funds for arts companies, obviously as a dancer, I see the benefit of dance, but I'm sitting here wondering, from a business perspective, what do business professionals have to gain by giving money to arts organizations?
What do they have to gain? I mean, it's also, it looks good to be giving back. It looks good to be supporting. There's a lot of people who have an affinity for an art form. And so if you can connect with that, there's also a lot of people now that want to give to development programs and to educational programs. So there's all of these different ways to attract people to what you're doing, but it has to be honest in that sense. And you have to have those programs in place to be able to say, hey, we've got this new initiative, you know, would you like to be a part of it? Or we're applying for this money because we have this new initiative. And yeah, does that new initiative align with the goals of your company, or is it being done just to be able to get some extra money in, and how's that being spent? And there's a lot around it. But I think that from my experience, there's a pride from companies and individuals that do it. They're proud of the fact that their contribution makes a difference. Might not be a contribution that is going to mean that, you know, there can be a new commission from X choreographer and they pay for it all, but even if it's just in the slightest way that they go to making something better for an arts organization. And I think a lot of people want to make things better for dancers, and so I think that's also why I, coming back to your earlier sort of question, I thought it was really important always that the dancers be involved in any kind of fundraising things. Even if it's a dinner or if there's a drink, like, invite the dancers, because people want to talk to the dancers. They want to know. They want to, you know, after a show, like, see the person they just saw on stage. And, you know, sometimes it can feel a little bit like, oh, you know, we're being, for want of a better word, sort of pimped out. But there is this... There can be this beautiful exchange. And in my experience, there are people that really enjoy it and there are people that don't. And for those that enjoy it, if you have people in your organization that are happy to have a drink and, you know, make some small talk with some guests, invite them, let them come. You know, we're the biggest advocates of our art form. We're not going to talk badly about it. And we can talk better about it than maybe somebody who's never done it before. And so it's only going to entice or make being a part and like donating more attractive to people.
Yeah. And also, I guess as a dancer, now we've experienced really not having an audience. So also, showing your gratitude as well and exactly. Getting amongst the people as well is important.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's always nice, and people always have, you know, similar questions. They want to know what it's like. They want to, you know, how do you remember steps? What's your day like? What's it like to be on the stage? I'm sure you guys know, like, there's something really nice about it. And yeah, you see, like, in other cultural contexts, like whole relationships developing between dancers and people, you know, outside, and them, you know, not that I think this is how it should necessarily go in Europe, but you see, you know, like a principal dancer with like somebody's name after them in like some big classical companies where, you know, like this family has such a connection with this dancer that they give X amount of money and then this dancer has their name after them. It's a bit odd, I do admit, but in that context, like it can be, like, relationships can form between artists and audience members. And if that can be beneficial for the company, I don't necessarily see it as being a bad thing.
The name thing is weird.
It is a bit bizarre. No, that was my first. I was like, oh, wow.
They get the name as part of their title or something?
No, it would just be like the name of the dancer. And then I've seen it say sort of sponsored by, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Or I don't think, you know, it's not like they pay for that person's salary or their costumes or something. It's just that that money goes into the general fund of the company and can be used wherever it's wanted. Okay. I'm presuming. And every time that principal's name is in the program and their picture is there afterwards, it says these other people's names.
That must be so annoying.
It would be weird, I think, to be the dancer. I think it would be bizarre to be the dancer of Mr. and Mrs.
I'd be questioning how much money they gave. what's my name worth?
yeah, I would like to know that too.
Hey, one thing I wanted to ask you about was that we spoke before about like the benefit of masters and how like having those letters associated with your name or your CV can help you progress your career. But oppositely, something that you pointed out in your thesis was that a lot of people who are in these positions haven't got that, I guess, experience, whether it be through experience or through education.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tricky one. And this sort of idea of the charismatic leader having these qualities that deem them right for the job without necessarily having that experience behind them. And it's a tricky one because you want to find the right people for the job, but there's also this sort of looseness around the artistic side, which kind of always remains a bit untouchable, and it's undefiable, and it's unquantifiable, and it, you know, you can't put your finger on it. What is it? What does this person have?
It's a bit ethereal, I guess.
Yeah, totally. And it should always remain that way, in my opinion. But I think what can help is looking at your strengths and weaknesses and listening to the organization when they say, well, this isn't necessarily working for us. And that's not about like artistic decisions or choices, because that's purely for that's that person's job. But again, when it comes down to like communication and structuring things, I feel like there does need to be some understanding or willingness to understand and implement things that help other people to do their jobs better, because ultimately that's what it's about, I think anyway. And we've just seen in recent years, like those examples that I wrote about where big ballet companies have their leadership has been called into question quite severely. And we've all got strengths and weaknesses, but by acknowledging our weaknesses and putting in whatever it is that's needed to support those weaknesses is, I think, the best thing that people can do in that position, because not everyone can be everything. Your mom and dad, they can't be everything, or your brother and sister, they're going to let you down, or your partner, like, they're not one person can be everything that's needed. But I really think there's a vulnerability to leadership that needs to be acknowledged, and for leaders to be able to put in the people that they need around them, and to have the willingness to recognize, like, okay, this is what I need to do to strengthen my team, not just artistically, but for the health of the organization.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess surrounding yourself with a team of people that can strengthen your weaknesses as well. And I suppose, also because if you're talking about an artistic director, then like you say, their main goal is the artistic vision of the company. And maybe if you're trying to strengthen the managerial side of yourself, then that can detract from your artistic qualities, maybe.
Totally. And I think really when you have like a creative, like an artistic director, so someone that's really like creating for the company, like they need that support system around them, because it's really two different things. It's really, you know, left brain, right brain, and everybody wants everything. So make the best piece that's going to be successful for the company and answer all of these questions and be in this meeting and, you know, make sure that you've read this report and that report and you're briefed for X, Y, and Z. Oh yeah, and it's all happening at the same time as your tech and the premier. Like, it's, you know, we have to, arts organizations, and I think boards especially, need to understand the complexity of what that is and be supportive of enabling that structure to be put in place to support
I guess elevating also the administrative and business side to be equal to the, because I feel like the artistic directorship position is kind of reigning over the top of the entire organization almost in a lot of cases.
What do you mean by in?
As in what, like that the, I guess you mentioned in your thesis the relationship between Killian and his sort of business administrative partner.
Yeah.
And I guess that sort of trust and equality of position is important then to run both sides of the organization.
Oh, definitely. And I can't talk to, you know, how that relationship was. I wasn't part of it. It's purely from research a little bit of my own understanding of the organization and the stories that I've heard. But yeah, it's really important that in all of the literature that I read about that dual leadership role, like that connection between that artistic and general or financial or executive, however it's called, the connection and the mutual understanding between the people in those two roles is really vital for the organization. And I feel a little bit what you might have been getting to before with that question, that the artistic kind of reigns. I think it does, purely because it's the outward facing part of the organization. And I feel like the other team are more the executive side is more the inward facing. So looking at, you know, the structures that are in place, the policy that the company has, more of these sort of organizational managerial things. And the artistic is what we all see on the outside. You know, it's the marketing material, it's the shows, it's the trailers, it's all of the stuff that we as a consumer of that product engage with. But I think that, like, internally in my experience, there seems to have been always like a good balance between those roles. But it is it is really important that relationship is one of trust and mutual vision for the company. Because if you've got one of them, one, you know, the artistic director going off here and the executive director going off in another direction, you know, the organization won't reach either.
Yeah, I think that's what I was getting at, is this idea of dual leadership and the importance of that relationship between the two people. I did have one more question sort of on the topic, and you mentioned Kevin O'Hare, the director of Royal Ballet, and the trajectory that he had throughout his career, where he kind of accrued experience in smaller roles in an administrative capacity at different companies. Maybe it's just my perception, but why isn't this kind of pathway more accessible to dancers?
In terms of reaching a position like that, or just that that pathway be open?
Yeah, that pathway, it feels like it's not really a common pathway that dancers take.
No, I don't know why that is. You know, I think it's also like one of the other things that was sort of written about in that section was that it's difficult to move up because there aren't necessarily the stepping stones to make those steps up and through an organization or a sector within arts and culture. It's not the same way as sort of in the commercial sector where there are kind of clear career paths that you kind of get, people kind of get on. And it doesn't seem to exist in the same way for us. And I don't really know why that is, but I think if dancers are interested in that, getting involved, you know, like asking questions in meetings, if you have that curiosity, explore it, like be a representative, join the OR, like go to the Dancers Council meetings, because these are all areas where you get to, you come into contact with those people and you start having those conversations which enable you to start forming an opinion about things and to also start seeing an organization from a broader perspective than just as a dancer, because there are so many things going on always and decisions that are being made that can help, I think, to, you know, be a catalyst for people with that interest to start developing themselves. It's also about timing, being in the right place at the right time, having leadership that values that, because, you know, I've experienced it in some places where it's not valued and opportunities maybe aren't created. You know, I was super lucky with the previous executive director at NDT, Janine Dijkmeyer. She was, when I was a dancer, she was always like asking me like, oh, what do you think? I would like to talk to you about this, or, you know, and it was really great because she really, I felt like supported and I felt like I could engage with her about topics that had she not been like that, it would have been much harder to bring it to her attention or even just to have a conversation about it without a goal or an agenda, but just to discuss as two people without that sort of dancer director roles placed upon us, but just that there was that dialogue that was able to happen. And yeah, she was also really instrumental in sort of introducing me to people, and she'd be like, oh, I'm going to this conference, would you like to come with me? And so I think that it also takes leaders who are willing to open doors and show people that do have interest the other side of the industry. Yeah, and I don't know how common that is, to be honest.
Yeah, I guess it depends. And you're right, it's like very much a timing or a look kind of setting. Like if there is a connection, if you have someone who they're not keeping the hierarchy like dynamic too strong, then if they are on the ground level talking to dancers, then it does make that connection feel more tangible to then navigate into that space because you're already part of the conversation. And then obviously you have to have had the interest to do that. But
exactly. And I feel like people though are becoming more interested. I do feel that just from ex-colleagues and like even this, what we're doing right now, you know, we're just talking and discussing, like, and that's for me, that's where it starts. It's a bit like you know, any creative process in the studio, you come together and you discuss with your body and you challenge each other with timing and dynamics instead of words and thoughts. And so I think it is happening. Again, I think it's this push from a younger generation wanting more information and wanting to be communicated with in a different way that is part of that. I see them being tied together or connected in some way. And I hope that this idea that dancers don't talk or dancers shouldn't talk or dancers shouldn't have an opinion, yes, it has changed a bit, but it's still there. Like it's still it still prevails, and
it's more that I think as a dancer, generally speaking, and I'm not like talking about my specific circumstances or anything, but like as a dancer, it can be confusing where to contribute and who to contribute mm-hmm. to.
But I think that's because there isn't enough space necessarily always created, or even just from an early stage, if we're talking like education or whatever, it's just not part of the culture or something that you're not being introduced to that part of the culture yet.
No, and it's not part of education to talk about it. And also, I feel like there's, you know, we have to look at why we were attracted to dance too. It's because we wanted to express something with our bodies and not necessarily verbally. So there are also those people who don't feel as comfortable to talk because they express in a physical way and not through a verbal way.
Yeah. And it's just like, I got into this because of that reason. So stop asking me to do that other thing. I completely agree. And I've thought this way too, but I think that's why it's important to encourage the other. But this is a whole topic that I would love to engage about, but we have already taken quite a lot of your time.
there's a lot to be discussed about.
There's a lot to be discussed about there. But while we're on, for a cheesy link, I love finding these. From going from the mind to the body, do you have a task for us?
No, I mean, I think, you know, like for any dancers that are out there that are listening to this, I would just say, don't be afraid to use your voice. You have one. You have unique insight into what it is that you do. And if there is something, a topic, if there is a question, if something isn't working, never ever be afraid to talk about it. So practice using your voice. You're going to have to use it when you stop dancing. So
true.
Yeah. And find a way to broach those difficult subjects. It's good to discuss, and it's okay to disagree, and it's okay to walk away and be like, okay, well, you think that and I think this. We can't change everything, and maybe it's not the time or the place, but we can enter into discussion.
Yeah, and I think it's good to find the people who you first feel safe discussing things with, people like the Dancers Council and other groups that are really about that. And I think that's a great training space for your voice. And then it will become easier then in the working field to do this.
Exactly.
Great. Yes. Thank you so much. I don't know if you have like any questions or anything else you want to add. You've already given us so much.
You know, it'll probably come to me in like a day and I'll be like, oh, I should have said this, or I'd like to say that. But, you know, ultimately I would just like to, thank you guys for this time, and for us to have this conversation, and and for what you're doing. I think it's really great. I said it before, but it's, you know, who knows where this will lead, that you're just starting something. And I think it's important in this time. We've had the time and the space, and it's these kinds of things. You know, if we all just had gone home and put our heads under a rock and then come out again like, oh, is it done yet? Okay, let's carry on. It's also a gift. What has been developed? How have people been resilient and creative in this time? And that's only going to add to the cultural offering that will be there when things start to come back to normal again. And so bravo for doing it. And I think it's great.
Cheers. That really means a lot. Great. Well, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. It was just really nice to meet you.
You guys too. And enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Thank you too.
Will do. Alrighty, guys. Take care.
Thanks for tuning into the Dance Rants podcast. Myself and Hayden, we really appreciate everybody who's been listening. For our next season, we're looking for new topics for myself and Hayden to engage with. So if you have anything, please contact us. Write us on Instagram or Facebook. And again, thanks for listening. This is Dylan, Hayden, and Rupert signing off.